come to find out why adolescent mental health is becoming such a popular...
Ничего не пишите.
Пишите.
Ничего не читайте.
Читайте.
Ничего не говорите.
Ничего не печатайте.
Public concern amidst rising rates of anxiety, depression, sleep problems, and self-harm. Is there a concern about mental health among adolescents at the moment in Sweden?
Yes, it really is. And it has been so for the last decades, starting in the 1990s, when Sweden experienced severe economic recession, and when it was recognized that it was an increasing pressure and requests for healthcare at the children and adolescents psychiatric clinics.
Kurt Hudquist, a professor of public health at Karlstad University. But can economic problems from back in the 1990s really by themselves be casting such a shadow on boys and girls who weren't even alive at the time? Even if, as critics claim, Sweden has been left with declining job availability and security, are there other things going on here? School counsellor Louise Boudin again.
They have a lot more pressure from school today than before. And then the pressure from society and social media, of course, that is a big influence on young people today. You have to be best at everything and beautiful and happy, and you have to show it.
Young Swedes are hardly alone in this, of course. There's mounting evidence from a number of countries that social media takes the various miseries of adolescence, from status and relationship anxieties to violently fluctuating self-esteem, and applies rocket boosters. Out goes the inflated playground boast, in comes the need to conjure up achievements worth broadcasting via Instagram or Snapchat. And if it used to be bad enough pretending to be a certain person between about 8:45 a.m. and 3:30 Monday to Friday, try living a life where all those pressures trail you out of the school gates, back home, and even climb into bed with you at night. Facebook filtering out all but your friends' finest moments. Twitter teaching you to monitor every passing thought for public acceptability. Add to that the nightmare of the playground bully now having all but unfettered access to you. And it shouldn't surprise us that social media, for all its virtues, might be contributing to adolescent pain in Sweden. But why would it be just adolescents? Swedish children use social media too, and yet the evidence suggests their mental health is relatively good. One of the many Swedish mental health workers starting to take an interest in all this is the psychiatrist David Eberhard. We went to see him at his clinic in Stockholm.
Hi there, I'm Chris.
Hi, David. Do you want some coffee or anything?
That'll be lovely.
We have this survey that was published, I think, 2011 from OECD that showed that Swedish 11-year-olds were the second happiest kids in the OECD. Only Finnish 11-year-olds were happier. The problem was that the Swedish 15-year-olds were among the least happy.
So something, or some things, seem to be happening at quite a specific point in the lives of young people in Sweden, as they move from childhood into adolescence. Eberhard says he's detected a change in the culture of adolescence, in types of vulnerability and help-seeking, from a previous generation into the present one.
I used to be the head of staff at the psychiatric emergency ward in Stockholm, St. Göran, which is Stockholm County own psychiatric emergency ward. And if you go back in time, 30 years, you had no patients that were seeking help because their girlfriend broke up with them or their dog died or something like that. Now, today, we have 5 or 6 cases like that every day, every day.
So it's people that have that experience and they rush themselves to the ward.
Yeah, to the emergency ward. And they say, help me, I must go on sick leave, I must have medication, I must have emergency psychotherapy, which is something that doesn't exist. But still, you know, they have really high demands on what kind of help they should get.
Eberhard acknowledges there's not enough data out there to be sure yet of a broader pattern here. But the OECD did warn Sweden in 2013 about the nearly €8 billion per year that mental illness appeared to be costing the economy in welfare payments and lost productivity. And the counsellors at Rudbeckianska School say they're seeing something very similar to what Eberhard described.
A lot of students that come to me because they're so depressed and sad about their boyfriend or girlfriend leaving them. And I don't think that 10 years ago that was such a big problem that you seeked out a counsellor to talk about that. You talk to your mother, you talk to your friends, and then it was solved. Maybe you were sad as well, but in these days, they come to a counselor or even to psychiatric wards. That's a problem that has to do something with their own identity. Years ago, what do you think? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
It's a new problem.
This is where the territory gets tricky. We saw in Japan that better public information about a condition like depression doesn't necessarily translate into permanent improvements in public understanding. The clock can be turned back. New forms of misunderstanding, even cynicism, can arise. And sufferers can then clam up again about what's happening to them. So perhaps one of the challenges that Sweden is facing is this. Can we have true mental health awareness with open public conversation to vulnerability, where we grow up learning to respond even to life's everyday troubles and injustices by getting caught up in our first reactions, dwelling on them as pathological, even giving them and ourselves a diagnostic label that won't really help? For Eberhard, one of the things that has brought Sweden to this difficult point are its parents.
Our generation that are born in the 60s and 70s were the worst parents ever, because we don't take it.
He's describing here so-called curling parenting, named after the winter sport from Scotland to Scandinavia. Parents supposedly try to clear their children's paths of obstacles, allowing them to glide through life like lovingly polished granite stones across assiduously swept ice. The problem with this style of parenting, says Eberhard, whose best-selling books on the topic have touched something of a nerve amongst fellow Swedes, comes when children get to an age where real life starts throwing up obstacles that parents can no longer sweep away. Children find themselves stuck, disappointed, or worse.
The interesting part happens when the parenting generation, like mine, and my kids, or the generation before mine, born in the 50s, they have no troubles whatsoever. And their kids, they have no trouble whatsoever. So you have two generations in a row that sort of gets everything they point at. Then we see the trouble, because then you don't have anyone in the older generation telling the kids that, well, shut up. This is just too narcissistic. Quit this now.
School counsellor Louise agrees that this curling style of parenting can eventually make life hard for children.
I think that they are not really ready for life, and every hardship that they encounter becomes a very big problem. So I think today that the levels of problems that young people want help with are normal problems that we go through in life. And I think that's a consequence of parenting, like with curling or helicopter parenting.
But how does contemporary Swedish parenting really differ from what goes on elsewhere in the world?
From a North American perspective, or even an Asian perspective, or a westernized perspective, one would say what Swedes are doing is not good because it's permissive. And permissive parenting creates children that are bratty, not listen, behaviorally problematic, and having issues in school.
That was Kari Trost, an associate professor in the Department of Child and Youth Studies at Stockholm University.
Swedes like consensus, and even at the family level. So where should we go on vacation where the child is a part of that? How should the rules look? When do you think you should come in tonight? So what we've been calling it is democratic parenting, because it seems more democratic, where everyone gets a vote and everyone's vote is equal. Whereas from another perspective, others may say that, what? Your teenager is deciding where you're going on vacation?
So it looks like we need to distinguish between permissive parenting and democratic parenting. Permissive isn't good and can lead to trouble. But democratic is what most Swedes are actually doing, and what the research seems to say works. But if, in trying to get to the bottom of Sweden's adolescent mental health worries, curling parents look to be something of a sore strumming, a fermented red herring, what is going on? The distress that young people are experiencing is certainly real enough. 19-year-old Clara sought the help of a school counsellor.
It was because I was feeling like really stressed out, and I felt like I didn't... It was a lot about my future and what I wanted to do about my future, and also problems with like my self-esteem and stuff like that.
Lots of the girls and boys we spoke to are finding the pressures of school increasingly hard to manage. 16-year-old Agnes.
It was the hardest like in the beginning of the year, because it's like it's a new school and it's new groups and like new people. They never met anyone before. And I remember that I felt like really lonely and I had like no one to talk to. So I think it was like my darkest. I cried a lot and I tried to focus like on my studies, but it's really hard to like focus on something, but when it's so many other things like in your mind.
But there are those in Sweden who point out that school was never an easy ride, and fretting about the future is something we all do. So is it time to ask whether Sweden really does have a problem here? Most of the dramatic statistics that are based on adolescent self-reports. Might those reports actually be evidence of a culture of vulnerability? Kurt Hugkist from Karlstad University again.
It has been questioned that the importance or severity of the problems that young people report in questionnaires about their psychosomatic problems. Some people previously comment on that, saying, for example, that it's a part of the growing up period. But obviously, these problems are important for the young people themselves. We should consider them to be serious.
He points in particular to Sweden. They've been falling across the population as a whole, but amongst young people, they're not changing.
That is a cause, I think, for concern. So that I means that we should take every measure to listen to the voices of the young people.
Since the mid-1990s, Sweden has been at the forefront of suicide prevention. Danuta Wasserman is professor of psychiatry and suicide prevention at the Karolinska Institute. She wants to see the Swedish government do more, devoting the kind of money and organisation it put into tackling the other main killer of young people, traffic accidents, into the prevention of suicide.
We can see that using preventive cutting traffic accidents, we are very successful in Sweden, and we are sure we can be as successful in the prevention of suicide and promotion of mental health.
Some of the suicide prevention methods that Professor Wasserman is helping to develop include helping young people to notice for themselves telltale changes in stress levels or emotions or thought patterns. But these methods rely too on adults, including teachers, being able accurately to spot young people who are at risk. So I wonder, is that task made more difficult if many adolescents are making psychiatrists and counsellors their first port of call for painful but relatively everyday troubles like relationship breakups? In a youth culture now so pervaded by the language of mental health and illness, where terms like depression, anxiety or trauma become widely used as idioms for really quite normal levels of distress, is there a danger of missing the people who really do need help?
We have always this problem that the ordinary life events and ordinary feelings, maybe we seek help as adults or we send our children for professional help. But according to my opinion, it's better to seek help once or twice too much than once or twice too less, because it can have serious consequences.
But Wasserman does see differences between the present generation and ones that have gone before, not least in the new stresses and strains of people's virtual lives.
I personally think that probably coping strategies can be poorer in that generation. Coping strategies, how to deal with the problems in real life, because we have a lot of virtual life now, and the kids are living in the virtual life, and it is not the same to train your coping styles in virtual life and to train your coping styles when you encounter a living human being next to you.
Sweden is facing a complex situation here, and it's about to become more so. Sweden took in around 163,000 asylum seekers last year, many of them of school and university age, including by far the largest number of unaccompanied children received by any country in Europe, 35,000. 17-year-old Sharif fled the Taliban, making an epic journey from Afghanistan to Sweden.
Yeah, we came by cars, smuggling the people, train, boats. The smugglers took us somewhere, I don't know where, but after a few hours they took us under the train. I was under the train. All the journey was scary.
It's impossible to know yet how traumatic experiences like these will affect Sharif and young people like him, not to mention what they've lived through before leaving places like Afghanistan and Syria. Sweden's National Board for Health and Welfare has estimated that between 20 and 30% of these asylum seekers may suffer from a diagnosable mental illness. But this is actually a similar figure to the existing Swedish population. The real contrast seems to lie between young Swedes increasingly encouraged to think and talk about their mental health, and newcomers who by and large have not been. Up until now, at least. Linda Flogstad runs the centre where Sharif and 30 other unaccompanied children currently live.
We have some kids that are very sad or very angry, and some of them think it's some kind of stigma to talk about it, and they don't think we can help anyway, so they keep it to themselves. Some of them, but we don't push them. If they want to talk, we listen, but if we see anyone really angry or sad, we try to make an appointment with the professionals.
Lena Jonsson is a teacher who works with young people like these in school every day. We caught up with her at an outdoor football tournament organized for her pupils, mostly boys from Afghanistan.
We are quite new with the students, and I think the more they know the Swedish language, I think they want to talk about it more also. And from the beginning, I mean, everything is new and they're very happy to start school. And I noticed that the problem catch them up after a while. So, yeah, some days they're quite sad and they can start cry. They think it's difficult to talk about. They say, oh, no, it's nothing. I don't want to talk about it. But it's coming more and more.
Like many Swedes you meet, Lena is optimistic that most of these boys and girls will be able to enjoy new lives in Sweden. But she worries about others.
Of course, some of them, it's going to be big problems, absolutely. But, I mean, it's not strange either. But because I think about their own personality, maybe the problems are very, very big and they can't cope with it. And they miss their family so much. They don't have... They don't want to stay here enough to work for it hard. They really talk about going back because it's tough for them without the family.
A Scottish doctor by the name of John Ferriar hinted 200 years ago that to understand mental illness, more desirable than a medical qualification, was Shakespeare. Reading the Bard, he thought, bestows an essential professional, not to mention human, talent for exquisite discernment. We've been given a feel here in Sweden for just how hard it can be to discern where in life the causes of young people's suffering lie. Some of the youngsters confess they don't always know what they should consider normal. Might that be because normal is a moving target? We've heard about coping strategies and coping styles. If strategy is a kind of add-on to who we already are, a technique we learn and deploy, then I think style is about who we become over much longer periods of time. Our expectations for what's normal, our habits and patterns of reacting to and dealing with life. And it's never set in stone. The world we live in keeps on influencing it across our lives. I wonder whether Sweden may be on the verge of new discoveries here. There's no doubting the importance of better awareness about mental illness, especially its early signs. But does it come with a danger, not just of the mental health equivalent of grade inflation, as critics claim, but also the promotion in some young people of a kind of hypersensitivity to unwelcome moods and thoughts, leading to a personal style at odds with what mental health advocates call resilience? If so, how do we give young people the health education they need without foisting upon them a high-pressure, medicalized preoccupation with themselves, as objects, as bearers of diagnoses, even as lifelong projects to be successfully managed? That was episode 2 of The Borders of Sanity. The next episode in the series looks at efforts in the UK to help people who hear voices understand and work creatively with their experiences.
You're with the BBC World Service. We'll bring you the latest from the newsroom in a couple of minutes, but first...
Before the cheers and adulation, before the sighs of relief, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.